We're doing Pirkei Avot together with the Jewish home, and we're up to the fourth chapter, the tenth Mishnah. Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir says, Heve mima'et ba'esek v'asok b'torah. Minimize your business and make your business Torah. Minimize your business and make your business Torah.
It doesn't sound good.
Very often, we find ourselves in life with all kinds of frustrations. Person wants to learn in yeshiva and make $1 million and be busy helping the poor and the sick and be a good son to his parents and a good sibling to his siblings and answer all the emails he gets and research everything that he wants to online. And he's very frustrated because he's not succeeding in answering every single email. He got the millions, he got the brothers, he's a good son, he's everything else, but he's a little behind on his emails. He's very frustrated when he goes to sleep at night. Now, this may sound funny to you, but in our day and age, we have a term which is, I think, a new term for the 21st century. It's called overachievers. Chazal said that tafasta merube lo tafasta. If you try to accomplish too much, you won't accomplish. I have a chavrusa that ends at 3 minutes to 9. And sometimes I show up to that chavrusa at 4 minutes to 9. And I'm very impressed that he doesn't open up the book. He says, I got to go, and he leaves. Because that's a person who knows what he can do and what he can't do. Personally, it's a weakness I have. Something I've been working on for many years. That if I showed up to that chavrusa at 4 minutes to 9, I'd say, let me try to get something in. And I'd end up leaving the chavrusa at 9:05 and being late to everything I had to do. When a person can say at 4 minutes to 9, I have to be out at 3 minutes to 9, I have to leave, that's a person that knows how to balance his life and knows what he can and cannot achieve. Now, it's a weakness of our day and age that we make ourselves goals that are unrealistic. And then we have frustrations that are not legitimate. People spend much of their lives being frustrated over things that really are unrealistic. They really cannot do that. Very often it helps to sit down and make a list of what times you have and what you could do with those times. Where do you want to go in life? Last time, in last class, we made a list. Where do you want to be in 20 years, in 15 years, in 5 years, in 6 months? Very often, when you look at that, if you sit down and then you start looking at your schedule, you'll see that you're not doing too much to get where you said you want to go. And then you have to ask yourselves, well, what can I do? And you have to be realistic. You need so much sleep. You need so much time to take care of things. There are things you're going to have to give up on. In the last year or two, I've been getting many alumni who have come back and told me that they're thinking of leaving Israel. People who are very Zionistic, people who gave up a lot to come to Israel, and people who have found that they cannot advance beyond a certain point in their job because they're not fluent in Hebrew. When they were in Machon Meir, the Upan was boring, so they did it to a point and then they left. They left Machon Meir and they got a decent job and they could fund their basic expenses, and then the family starts growing and they reach a point where they can't move forward at this point. They're not going to be advanced in their job. They can't look for a higher position because their Hebrew is not up to par. Usually what I tell them is, do you want to live in Israel or don't you want to live in Israel? And usually they say, I do. I figure I'll go to the States, I'll make more money, I'll get better on my Hebrew, I'll come back. And I say, you ain't getting better on your Hebrew in the States. That's not going to happen. So if you've only gotten this far this time, next time you come back, you're not going to have it easier. Your kids will be older, the integration is going to be harder. So then what's the solution? The solution is to recognize that I have to work on my Hebrew and I'm going to have to pay a price. Very often we are unwilling to pay the price and then we don't understand how come we're not achieving what we'd like to achieve. So I always tell them, sit down with your wives and see what family time you're going to be able to cut, because you're not going to be able to cut work time. So see what other time you're going to be able to cut and what's going to least infringe on your families, and then figure out how you could improve your Hebrew and see in 3 months and 6 months where you could go with that. The Mishnah begins by telling us, you're going to have to do less business if you want to deal in Torah. People think, I'll run a business, I'll do everything, and I'll be able to learn Torah. Yeah, it doesn't work that way. Once upon a time, you could run a business, and you had to travel by horse and buggy a month in each direction to make a transaction, and then you could learn all the time you were traveling by horse and buggy. So today you could learn on a plane. But you know what? You're not spending most of your business on the plane. And today you're expected to answer emails on a plane too, right? They have that now. So you don't have a free minute. The Mishnah tells us there's a price. And one of the difficulties in married life is realizing that there's a price. Very often, us men are unrealistic about our expectations. We have all kinds of dreams and fantasies about how a house should look. And when those dreams and fantasies don't come true, so then we wonder, why is it that way? And what our wives usually do is they spell out before us the facts, the real facts of the matter. And then we get frustrated. But our frustration stems from the fact that we haven't made a realistic calculation of what the investment has to be and what the product's going to be. Let's take a simple example. A husband says, I want one thing. I want that when I come home, you'll be calm and happy. Simple request, right? Well, let's analyze that. How simple is that? What time are you walking through the door? Just after bedtime, just in the middle of bedtime, just after supper time, just before supper time. Let's analyze what your wife is going through, and then let's see, is it realistic to expect that? How many things does she have to contend with before you come? So you want her to be calm and with a smile? You try it. Let's switch. Very often, we look at the bottom line. This is what I want. Why can't it be that way? Well, the Mishnah tells you there's always a give and take. You want to learn Torah? You're going to have to give up on some business. You want certain things to run a certain way? Well, you're going to have to invest in it. A person has to be prepared to do less business and learn Torah. There are different stages in life. Sometimes a person says, I have to find a job. True. Sometimes a person says, I have to get ahead in my job. True. Sometimes a person says, I have an important project in my job. True. There's rarely a time when you won't have a million excuses not to learn Torah. There are always reasons not to learn. Right now you have it easy. You're in a bubble. It's called Machon Meir. You're not doing business. Life is easy. I'm not saying there aren't hardships. You could have a nagging roommate. You could have a class you don't like, other than mine, of course. You could have all kinds of things. But in life, the nature of things is that there's going to have to be a price for learning Torah. The Mishnah addresses that. It says, step one, Heve Mimet Ba'esek. Step two, Vasok B'Torah. If a person thinks, I'll learn more Torah, but I won't have to pay the price, he's in for a surprise. The Jerusalem Talmud says there was once a rabbi who came to a town, and they told him, go look at that Rebbe, such a pious person, he fasts, and he does all kinds of pious things. So he went to meet that Rebbe, and he said, tell me, sir, are you allowed to take your cow all night long and use it to plow? And when it's finished working all night, go and rent out that cow as though it were a fresh cow in the morning? So he says, no, that's thievery. So the rabbi said to him, if that's the way it is in things that are of monetary issues, how much more so in God's issues? You're learning and teaching God's Torah, right? You need proper strength for that. You think you're going to fast and do all kinds of extra pious things and be the same quality Rebbe you're supposed to be? It won't work. You want to teach? You have to have the proper amount of sleep. You have to have the tools and the strength to be able to do it. The Mishnah tells us, you want to learn? So there's going to be a price. You're going to have to take a few hours off. You're going to have to take a certain time off. And only then will you be able to learn. And again, I'm harping on this point because I think it's a very important educational point that our generation lacks. We are all what they call overachievers, and what the Talmud would call people who are trying to achieve beyond their means, and then it goes bust. There's only so much you can do. So the Mishnah says, calculate, and you're going to have to reduce some of the work time in order to learn. Ve'vei shfal ruach bifnei kol adam. And be humble before every man. The Mishnah didn't have to tell me to be humble in front of someone who I think to be humble, right? The Mishnah stressing bifnei kol adam. That means even the checkout clerk who's a new girl who has no clue what she's doing. I had an interesting experience 2 weeks ago. I was in the hospital for Shabbos. One of the kids had a tooth infection that blew up his whole face, and until they could deal with it, they wanted him on antibiotics, on IV. So we were in the hospital for Shabbos. And it wasn't Shaarei Tzedek, because they don't have a jaw department. We go down to the meal, and they have a place where they have special badatz meals at this hospital. So we sit down Friday night, and two people sit opposite us. Two people who just had a heart attack. I look at one of them, and I say, I know you. So he starts telling me where he's worked. And after about 3 minutes, I remembered where I knew him from. The story goes back about a year and a half ago. I had taken a taxi with all the kids and luggage, and the driver tried to rip us off. And this was the man who was sitting opposite me, Shabbos, Friday night at the table. What?
It was the driver?
The driver. So we had just come in, we had visited my parents, we had just come in, and I had called Nesher in advance because I knew I could hire a private taxi, it would have cost the same amount. You know, you reach a point where you have so much luggage and the family, you're going to pay almost the same price on a bus. So I got the exact fare and everything, and I come to the guy, and he says to me, that's awful big luggage you got there. And I asked him the price before I loaded the stuff, and I called from the States. I said, look, this is the legal luggage. This is what the plane takes. You guys are supposed to take from the airport. I called in advance. This is the price they told me. And he only started arguing with me after he had loaded all the pieces of luggage. So I said, we discussed the price before you loaded it. You don't want that price. Let's take it off. So he tells me, no, what do you have to be so tough for? I said, I'm not being tough. I called you guys before I came on this flight, and you guys told me the price. He said, yeah, we didn't know it was such big luggage. I said, no, it's luggage that's the same size that the plane allows me to. If you have a different criterion, you have to tell me that. So the guy wasn't very happy with me, and the whole ride he's cursing me out. And when he drops me off, he curses me out so that all the neighbors could hear it too. And now comes Friday night, I'm sitting opposite him at the table, and I say, I know you. And then he starts telling me his work history. So after about 3 minutes, I remembered where I knew him from. I didn't say it. No, I didn't say it. No, 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 no. We're good friends today. I'm still davening for it. I didn't say it. No. But I remember that when I was arguing with him, I had a question in my mind. He went beneath a certain level in the way he was talking to me in front of all the other passengers and my own children and then all my neighbors. And, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning or 8:30, everyone's taking out their kids. It's not very comfortable to be standing outside with a Nesher guy. I haven't slept all night. I'm just off a plane. I'm not exactly in any mood to be too polite to this person. And he's cursing me out on something that is very clear that he's not being fair. And I remember arguing with myself, like, what point should I go to? Like, he's wrong, but, it's a constant struggle with yourself. One of the keys to being able to answer a person fairly and correctly, even when they're wrong, the Mishnah says, Hevei shfal ruach bifnei kol adam. We answer differently depending on how proud we feel. When a person can think a little bit to himself and say to himself, why do I think I'm more entitled than him? He's wrong. And he's wrong in talking to me this way. When I sat at the table Friday night, I felt terrible. Not about him, about me. Because I said to myself, this guy has been schlepping heavy bags. He complained that my bags were too heavy. Legally, he was wrong. What about morally? Schlepping heavy bags gave him a heart attack. He ended up in the hospital, right? So why did I make a big deal about paying him? What would it have made a difference to pay him another 20 shekel? The guy did end up in the hospital and lost his job. I'm sitting with him Shabbos, and he's talking to me about how he's not going to have a job. He doesn't know what he's going to do, but he's thankful to have his life. We went to shul together. He asked me to show him where the parasha was. We're good friends. He doesn't know this part of the story. I didn't tell him. What? I don't think so. No, the guy didn't know the first thing about shul. But one of the things that struck me was that he was arguing with me because they were good meals while I was eating badats. It struck me how suddenly my perspective was different. When I was on the ride back, I was thinking, I just spent everything, and he's not in the right. I'm in the right. He's so wrong. But then when I'm sitting opposite him after he's had the heart attack from carrying all these bags, suddenly I look at it differently. Suddenly I say, wait a second, was it worth the heartache?
But wait, if you had paid 20 more shekels, it wouldn't have saved him the heart attack.
I'm not saying it would have saved him the heart attack, but you agree your perspective is different? After you see it landed the guy in the hospital, and now he's without a job? So the guy tells me, I have to carry your heavy bags with my heart condition, and I'm looking at him, and I'm saying, I didn't tell you. I remember thinking to myself when he said it, I didn't tell you to get a job schlepping heavy bags with a heart condition. I didn't ask you, you know. But then you ask yourself, you know, the poor guy, how's he going to make a living? You know, it's very easy to stand on the sidelines and say, I didn't tell you to get this job. Right, okay, but what, you know, obviously he needed to, otherwise he wouldn't have put himself in that situation. Half the reason I thought that was because I didn't believe him anyways, because when the guy's trying to trip you up, so of course he has a heart condition. Okay, but then when I'm sitting opposite him after he had the heart attack and I'm in the hospital, so then you look at it a little differently. Hevesh faruach b'fnei kol adam. The Mishnah says, the way to deal with people is to be humble in front of everyone. You don't have to give in. The Mishnah isn't telling you give in. The Mishnah is saying, but there's a different way of dealing with people. There's dealing with a person out of a proud stance, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, and okay, we'll fight it out, I know I'm in my rights. And then there's talking to a person gently and saying, you know, I'm very sorry, but two different ways. You don't have to give in. You could get to the same final point. But the question is, how do you deal with the person? Yeah.
Oh, what I was going to say is that maybe his heart attack wasn't so much from carrying the bags, but from arguing with all the passengers.
Oh, but that doesn't put me in the right either. Meaning, he's right, he's wrong. Very often, we have to gauge ourselves. I'm not saying he's right. I'm not coming to say he was right. My question is, was I right? Meaning, a person doesn't always have to look at, you know, if he's wrong, so then I'm right. No, could be he's wrong, and I'm wrong. Could be he's wrong, and I could have and should have done better. Meaning, they're two separate questions. Whether he's right or wrong, he's wrong. There's no question. He was wrong. I mean, I called up, I got the price, I didn't do anything different than what they told me, and he's trying to take more money off me. I don't know what to do. Okay, he's arguing a point which was unfair, and even more so, because I asked them the price before they loaded the bags. I didn't even count on what they told me by the phone, which I could have done. I could have ordered. I could have ordered a van. It would have cost me almost the same. I figured I'll give them the parnasa. So I'm not saying he's in the right. But that doesn't mean I'm in the right. Then you look back and you ask yourself, could you have said it more gently? Could you have said it in a way that would have gotten him less upset? That's a question about me and myself. It's not a question to him. Between me and him, he's wrong. You know, okay, you're right. He didn't have to start the fight. And I don't see any, you know, sometimes you can have an argument and you could say, I see my angle, I see his angle, I think my angle's right, but I see his angle. I don't see his angle here. I don't think he's in the right. But I still, in hindsight, you ask yourself, okay, how could it have been better? The Mishnah says, Avesh fal ruach b'fnei kol adam. There's a way of talking to people, and the Mishnah says a person should try to be humble in front of everyone. And when the Mishnah says everyone, the Mishnah is stressing specifically in instances where You don't feel like it. You don't think you should be. The Mishnah says, no. What type of person should you be? Now again, that doesn't mean you should give in. But the demeanor, the way of doing things should be a way of humility. Yes?
Can we also think that the Mishnah is also telling us to prevent ourselves from embarrassing someone and from
What do you mean?
By being humble with someone, you're not shouting at him. You might embarrass him. You make your because an error. You might be doing an error. If you start to fight with this person, and maybe you end up also insulting him or something like that, you also might get embarrassed. So you will be doing an error.
Okay, fine. I think that it's like when people ask me how they should call their in-laws, I always say the Jerusalem Talmud says that you call your father-in-law Abba, and obviously your mother-in-law Ima. And it's much easier to say something nasty when you say your father than when you say Abba. You know, your father sounds differently. Your mother sounds differently than Ima or Abba. The second you use those terms, you're going to talk a little differently. And the same thing when you talk to them. Aside from which, it's a chinuch point. It's good for the kids that they see that both parents talk about both grandparents as Abba and Ima. So I agree that the second you use certain terminology and you use a certain attitude, so then it helps in many aspects. It helps keep things under control. It's good to see you. Yeah.
What's the difference between Shparua and Anah?
Excellent question. It deserves its own class. That's an excellent, excellent question. I translated humility, and I was debating whether that's a fair translation, because really Shpal Ruach is a little different than humility. Shpal Ruach, if we'll say it in two words, it's more than humility. Shpal Ruach is to the point where we might even say lowly. When a person is, it's more than humility. It's I'll give you an example. When the Medrash wants to explain how Shval Ruach Moshe Rabbeinu was, so the Medrash says there are all kinds of diseases in the world. Take the worst disease that anyone who sees it cringes and stays far away from it, and then like it's very. And when a person has that, he knows that people are uncomfortable talking to him, and it automatically makes him feel a little bit less than everyone else. And Moshe was less than that. You could talk about a person that has a stutter. You could talk about there are different things that cause a person to feel inferior to other people. And Shfal Ruach really is an attitude of inferiority. But when we translate it that way, it sounds like a negative. It sounds like it's already a psychological problem. So that's why I translated it as humble, because I don't know of an accurate translation that connotes, on the one hand, the perspective of inferiority, whereas on the other hand, maintaining a correct psychological balance. So I use the term humble, even though you're right. It's not really an accurate translation. Shval Ruach is different than humility. It's to the point where you treat people with respect because you don't feel like you're better than them. It's different than humility. But again, it deserves a whole class. Okay, call Kavod for pointing it out. Yeah. The Mishnah continues and says, "Im batalta min haTorah." If you wasted your time from learning Torah, יש לך בטלים הרבה כנגדך. So then you should know that there'll be many opportunities to waste your time. There'll be a lot of things to take your time. It won't only be about answering that important email. It'll be about checking what are all those deals they sent you. And just catching up with everyone on Facebook. And just sending an SMS and replying to an SMS. And before you know it, the night's gone. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You didn't learn a word and you didn't do anything productive. And this
messages from Facebook?
What?
Individual messages from Facebook?
I don't know. I think this brings us to the point of newspapers in the home. Newspapers, email, Facebook. We have a lot of things that can enter the home that attract us and cause us to be very busy when we're really wasting our time. And it comes at the expense of our spouse, it comes at the expense of our children, and it comes at the expense of ourselves and our own quality of life. It used to be the newspaper. It used to be, and it probably still is on Shabbos, the newspaper. That you finish the Shabbos meal, and you have opportunity to develop your relationship with your spouse or with your children. I'm a big fan of playing board games. I think it's a nice thing that when couples get married, they should buy themselves Rummy Cub or something else that's innocent that couples can play Friday night. And it's a nice, innocent way to play. It's always interesting to see. Very often among couples, one is very into winning. Sometimes it's the man, sometimes it's the woman. Doesn't matter. But it's still, it's a good way for couples to have some easy, relaxed time together. Some people like to walk together. When you have babies, it starts being more difficult to get out, and then you have to figure out how to be in and have easy time together. But if you pick up that newspaper, then what happens is you become engrossed in something, and it's not your wife, and it's not your kids, and it's not doing the dishes, and it's not clearing the table. And then suddenly, your wife is less important than the newspaper. If you'll ask any man, he will swear that she is more important than the newspaper. But for some reason, while he's reading the article, he's not very focused on what she wants, to put it mildly. And he's not very focused on helping around the house. And if you'll ask him, he'll say, I'm just taking a break, I'm just catching up on the news. Today, it's very easy. We catch up on the news all the time. You can get those RSS feeds, you can see the headlines. You could waste a lot of time on it, but it shouldn't be family time. It shouldn't be work time either. A person has to realize that today we're having problems building connections in the homes because we're focused externally. Our focus is outward. You're reading your SMS, you're reading your palm, you're reading the news. You're not with your spouse. You know? Yeah, guys, you understand? Be with me. Yeah. So what I was saying is that, just a second. You notice how people talk to you that way? Every 2 seconds they're on their palm just SMSing. Dad, I got to talk to you. Yes. Yeah, what were you saying? Oh, so you're thinking of dropping me out of high school. Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. You really think you should drop me? One second. You guys think I'm joking? No, I'm not joking. People are proposing, and as they're proposing, they're checking their palm. It sounds ridiculous, but that's where the world is today. And if you don't stop it here and say to yourself, I'm going to take times when I'm focused, then you're going to find yourself the way most of the world is today. People are very perturbed that I don't walk around with the cell phone. One person told me, you must be a very important person if you don't walk around with a cell phone. I just say, I say every morning, Shalom Asani Oved. I bless God for not being a slave. I don't have to walk around with a leash around my neck. People should be able to contact me every minute. There are times that I'm on call. So if I'm on call, I'm with a cell phone, fine. Not as a doctor, no. Sometimes as a moel, sometimes for other things. So there are times, you guys know, so if I'm here with a cell phone in class, it's because I'm on call, otherwise it wouldn't be it. Sometimes we order pizza, I got to have a cell phone in order to get the pizza, but ordinarily I'm without a cell phone. Newspapers, cell phones, computers. There are a lot of things that will grab your attention. The telephone at home. Why do I have to stop a conversation with someone because someone else rang? Yeah. Why do I have to stop a conversation because someone knocked on the door? I don't have to answer. People get very annoyed. You don't answer the door. So I learned, you put a sign on the door. Please don't knock. I can't answer now. I never promised I'm going to answer the door every time someone knocks. Right now I'm talking to my son. Maybe that's more important than answering the door. And what am I telling my son when I'm learning with him or I'm talking to him or my spouse? And suddenly there's a phone, and I say, I'll get back to you, and I go to the phone. I don't know who's on the phone. I have a friend who will talk to you, and then the phone will ring, and I'll say, I'm sorry, this might be important. And I always think, oh, so this isn't important. That might be important. Okay. I understand. He's trying to tell me, you're important, but this might also be important. Okay. But
it's not different when you are with someone in your house and someone calls. The person is not there, but if someone knocks, the person is there.
Right.
It's not that different?
That's why I sometimes put a sign on the door. I didn't invite anyone. So he chose to come, and I'm busy now. So if I weren't here, I wouldn't answer the door, right? My great-grandfather, Yisachar Tzvi Rosmarin, was a man who dealt a lot with helping people in the public. He did chesed all the time. And he'd rarely finish a meal at home, because every time in the middle of the meal, something very important would come up, and he'd have to go and help. So his wife got into the habit that when people would knock at the door, and he was in the middle of eating, she'd say, "I'm sorry, he died." They'd say, "He died?" She said, "Yeah, when he's eating the meal, the world is dead or he's dead, but he's not leaving the meal." And that's how she decided to ensure he eats a normal meal. Okay, so that's a little extreme. I guess in those days you could get away with that. Today, there are so many distractions that if you don't put a stop at some point, then you're never going to be able to dedicate time to what's really important in life. There's one piece of advice that I give couples that they usually come back and say thank you for. There's one piece of advice that I tell every couple when they get engaged, and usually they come back and say thank you for this piece of advice. It's not my own invention. It was advice that I was given when I was engaged to. I tell them, the first month that you're married, disconnect the phones at night. Shut the cell phones, disconnect the house phones, let people leave you messages. Don't be available at night. At night, just sit down and talk. Have some time together. And I always tell them, I would tell you to do this for 3 months. You're going to think I'm crazy. How could you shut the phone and disconnect from the world for 3 months straight? Do it 1 month. After 1 month, you'll see how good it is. You'll volunteer on your own to take on another 2 months. And tens, if not hundreds, of couples have already told me they did this. Everyone used to laugh. When we got married in Teves. So our voicemail said, "Thank you for calling. You can leave a message. We will listen to the messages after Tu B'Shvat." A month later. Now, there's a history behind that. The morning after the wedding, at about 6:30 in the morning, the phone started ringing. So I was like, 6:30 in the morning? Who needs me at 6:30 in the morning? Why are people calling 6:30 in the morning? I just got back from the wedding 3 hours ago. Okay, so then I decided that's it. That was a straw that broke the camel's back. I left a message. Came to B'Shvat. I said, "Thank you for calling. We will return calls after Purim." And came Purim, I said, after Pesach. And after Pesach, no one was calling anymore. Everyone in the family joked, "Don't bother calling, they're not calling you back." But the truth is, what? There weren't that many messages. But you have to find time to be together. And I'm telling you again, this is one piece of advice that most couples thanked me for afterwards and then came back and said they took on the next month themselves. And they realize that if they don't shut the phones at night, so then his mother calls and her friends call and his friends call, and at the end of the day, they don't spend any time together. And it's not only for the first months that we're married. If you're sitting down to have an important conversation with your son, you should have important conversation with your kids. It's not only when they do something wrong in school, it's also because you want to learn with them, you want to tell them you love them, you want to read them a story. That's an important conversation. So then you're giving them a very powerful message when you disconnect the phone. Or when you say, if anyone calls, tell them I'm not available. What you're telling him is, you're important to me. And other things are not as important right now. How many times do you tell your kid, "I can't talk to you right now. I have to be on the phone. I have to deal with this. I have to deal with that." When do you ever tell him you're important and I can't talk to other people? So what message is he getting? And so the Mishnah tells us, when it comes to Torah, if you're going to try to find things, if you're going to waste your time, there are plenty of things to waste your time. But it's not only about Torah. It's about everything that's important in life. If we won't stop and say, this is important to me and I'm going to focus on it, then today more than ever, there are going to be a lot of distractions that take us away from what's really important in life. People don't have time to talk. People go to sleep with their cell phone next to their bed. I always say, leave everything out the bedroom door. When you close that bedroom door, no one else belongs in there. Not your cell phone, not your rabbi. I even say when people ask me for questions, I say, do me just one favor. Don't ever quote me in the bedroom. Just do me that favor, okay? Like when we learn the halachas of laws of family purity, I always say, the halacha says that a couple should be intimate past midnight because you don't want that he should hear anyone or she should hear anyone and think about anyone else. The halacha is very focused that when a couple is intimate, they should only be thinking about one another. They shouldn't think about anyone else. So I always say, if the halacha didn't want you to be intimate at a time where you might hear anyone else because you might think of someone else, so you certainly shouldn't mention other people in the bedroom. You guys should be focused on one another. So even if we're discussing the halachas, don't tell her Rabbi Frankenthal said, I don't belong in there. You're not supposed to bring anyone else. No one belongs in there. It's you too. The halach always says you should say something in someone's name. I always say, except for this. Here, no one's name belongs in there. You shouldn't be thinking about anyone else. The couple is supposed to have time that they're focused on one another. So I think that the same thing would hold true for a cell phone. Or if anyone's going to make that terrible decision of having a television at home, it shouldn't be in the bedroom. You know, at least when you're there, you should be together.
If so it's something, enjoying a TV program together, then, let's say.
Yeah, but how many times is it that you're enjoying a TV program together, and how many times is it that you're focused on that and not on your wife, or she's focused on that and not on her husband? I think that those times will outnumber the other times, and I think that most wives will be very appreciative if they can have a husband that spends time with them and is focused on them, and it's a small price to pay not to have the television in the bedroom. You'll have to think of the chinuch consequences, because if the TV is easily accessible to the kids, then that's a different price you're paying. So I'm saying, okay, those are the calculations a person has to make. The Mishnah concludes and says, "V'imamalta b'Torah." Yesh sachar harbe litenach. What does the word amalta mean?
Worked hard.
If you worked hard on Torah, then God has a lot of wages to give you. Don't worry about the wages. There's what to give. We have to realize that it's amal. It's hard work. And very often we want to get the wages, but we're going to put in a short day. There's a saying that says, the worker does the minimum he has to do not to get fired, and the boss pays him the minimum he has to pay him so as he doesn't quit. Well, it doesn't work that way in Torah. There's limitless amount of wages to be given, the Mishnah says, if you're only willing to work hard. And to conclude, so what we see in this Mishnah, the Mishnah said, firstly, there's always going to be a price. It began by saying, do little business, minimize a certain amount of your business in order to be able to be focused on learning Torah. And we said that's an approach we have to develop in life, to realize that things have a price, and not to try to be overachievers, to try to achieve things that are beyond our capacity and then be frustrated with what we have achieved, but rather realize what we could and could not achieve and realize the price it takes to achieve things. The Mishnah said, "Avei shfaluach b'fnei kol adam," a person should be humble, as Yoav correctly pointed out, shfaluach is beyond humility, in the face of any person. The Mishnah said, if a person wastes the time from Torah, then there are many distractions that await to attract the person. And we discussed how in family life that's also true, that there are many distractions that will take a person away from developing his family life. And the Mishnah concluded and said, if you toiled, if you worked hard in Torah, there are great wages to give you. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, we'll conclude with Mishnah Yud Aleph. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says, "Haoseh mitzvah achat koneh lo praklit achat." A person did one mitzvah, he gets himself a defense attorney in heaven. There's an angel waiting there to speak good on his behalf. "Ba'aveir aveira achat koneh lo kategor echad." And a person who did one sin, well, he's getting a prosecutor in heaven. He's created an angel that will prosecute him when the time comes. "Tshuva ma'asim tovim kitlis bifnei apuranut." But doing tshuva, repenting, and good deeds are like a protector, like a shield before terrible things happening. Now, the Mishnah is teaching us a very important perspective. Most of us, when we approach Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you tell a person you have to do tshuva, so he thinks back over the year. He could think of one thing, two things, he could think of what happened this past week, but you ask him what happened all year long, he must have been a tzaddik, because he doesn't remember anything. The nature of people is that we tend to forget what we did wrong. If a person said something hurtful to his spouse, so 5 minutes later, from his perspective, it's over. And if the spouse holds it against him, so then, she never lets go. No, maybe she's very hurt. We find it very easy to forget what we did wrong. And the Mishnah tells us that in heaven it doesn't work that way. Every action that was done right gets recorded, and every action that was done wrong gets recorded. And every action has an effect. What the Mishnah calls it creates an angel. And we have to know that this is true in our daily lives. We don't have to wait to get to heaven to find this out. We do things, they have an effect. And we shouldn't be so quick to forgive ourselves. It's important not to become depressed, but it's also important to stop and realize if I did something wrong, I have to make amends. I have to go and say I'm sorry. And I have to say I'm sorry emphatically. Kids were playing. One of the kids knocked down a big thing on the other kid. Bashed the kid in the head, threw him halfway across the room. So the little one is sitting there crying, and the big one looks at him and says, "Oh, I did that. I'm sorry," and goes on playing. So I looked at that scene and I said to myself, that's the way we all are. You know, this little one just got bashed over the head like big time. I didn't pick him up. I wanted to make sure that he could move. You know, you have to make sure there wasn't any spinal injury. I'm standing there waiting as he's crying to see that he could really move before I pick him up and kiss him. And the big one's already playing again. He said, "I'm sorry," and keeps going. But that's the way we all are. We can bash someone else's feelings. And the best we do is we say, "Oh, I'm sorry," and keep going. The Mishnah says, no, there's an effect. There's an effect in that person. There's an effect in heavens. Then if we want to make amends, we have to invest the amount that it requires. So then, just like I told the older kid, stop for a minute. Your sibling is still crying. You can't just go on playing and just because you said, "I'm sorry," go on with your life. Ask them if they want nice back. Ask them if they're feeling better. React. Invest a little bit of emotion because you did something. I understand you didn't mean to do it, but you can't just keep playing while he's sitting here weeping. So then they came over. "Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, they didn't mean it, but okay. It's a start." But the truth is that we do the same thing. And we also have to train ourselves. And the Mishnah tells us we can't just overlook what we've done. We have to know positive things have a positive effect, which keeps recorded. And things that are not positive, well, they also get recorded. And this is one of the key points in marriage. Very often, couples don't work things out because people are not willing to recognize the impact of what they did. So then they come with claims to the other side, "Why can't you just forgive and forget? Why can't you just move on?" That's not fair. If the other side is hurt, then you can't just say, "Well, I don't think you should be so hurt." Okay, so you don't think so, but they are. If you agree that what you did was wrong, so then you have to figure out how to make the other side happy, how to work things out. And that's what the Mishnah says, Shuvah masim tovim. On the one hand, doing tshuva, repenting. On the other hand, doing the positive. You can't just focus on undoing the past. You also have to focus on doing more positive in the future. And that's what prevents harmful things from happening. Rabbi Yochanan HaSandlar omer, kol knesia shei l'shem shamayim sofa leitkayem. Rabbi Yochanan HaSandlar, meaning he worked on fixing sandals, that was his livelihood. Rabbi Yochanan the Sandlar, he said, kol knesia shei l'shem shamayim. Anytime people gather for the sake of heaven, sofa leitkayem, they will find that what they're focused on will ultimately stand. Whatever their plan is, whatever they try to accomplish, if they do it for the sake of heaven, it will succeed. Ultimately, when people unify and it's not for the sake of heaven, it doesn't last. And this is a formula for a lot of things in life. One of the most dangerous things in the world is when people think they're l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. The Mishnah tells us if you're really for the sake of heaven, it doesn't have to be only about learning Torah. It could be about a question that the whole building has to decide whether they should raise the vad bayit. What do they call that in English? The tax... the levies. If you're doing it really for a correct purpose, then ultimately something good will come of it. If it's not really for the correct purpose, it's because the guy who's in charge wants to pocket more money without anyone noticing, ultimately it explodes. And this sounds like a very simple Mishnah. If you think about it, we very often con ourselves and overlook this Mishnah. We figure, if I'll just do it this way, I'll get away with it. And the Mishnah says, no. If you put everyone together, you should know there's a big question, and it's like a segula. It'll work if it's really done for the correct purpose. And Chazal applied this to many things in life, where Chazal said the reasoning behind things ultimately surfaces. We like to think that we could keep things under wraps. Chazal say, why do you get married? If you married someone for her money, Chazal say, don't worry, you'll die and you won't end up enjoying her money. Chazal gave us all kinds of formulas. Why did you befriend him? Why did you enter this relationship? Chazal say that the real motives that people have ultimately surface, and then they either cause the endeavor to succeed more because the endeavors are really with a correct, fair purpose, and when it's the other way, so then it surfaces to the detriment of the endeavor. But again, this is a dangerous term, because L'shem Shemayim, I think more people have been killed and slandered and hurt for the sake of heaven than anything else. We'll conclude with a joke, but it's a joke that has a true core to it. The Talmud says that the Satan in the book of Job and Pnina in the book of Shmuel, in the book of Samuel, Pnina, who used to constantly torment the other wife, Hannah. Hannah couldn't have kids. Pnina would constantly torment her. She'd say, did you buy anything new for your kid today? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't have kids, I forgot. She'd say all kinds of nasty things. The Talmud says, just like Satan in the book of Job meant for the sake of heaven, whatever that means, so too Pnina, as she was tormenting the other wife, Hannah, meant for the sake of heaven. So they ask, how did the Talmud know that Pnina meant for the sake of heaven? Satan is an angel, okay. But how did they know that Pnina meant for the sake of heaven? So the answer goes that to be so cruel, well, you could only be so cruel if you mean it for the sake of heaven. Laila Tov.